in the skip zone because the ionosphere is very frequency sensitive and angle sensitive. And the MUF and critical frequencies and whatever try to define some of this. Is this closer to what's going on here, Bell? Go ahead.
Let me just say something, WHCM. Throwing something. Because I remember, and I can, you're defining it pretty well, but we never understood what MUF meant. When I was active on 10 meters back in the 70s, the word MUF was used a lot because when the band was in good shape, and 10 meters, you know, when that band is open, you don't need much power. I was literally working not more than 5 watts to work stations in Greenland and so on. But I remember tuning around the band and hearing people say, well, don't go above this particular frequency because you're reaching the MUF, you're reaching the maximum usable frequency, and above that, you're not going to get anything. And I do recall the band being dead above that frequency. You wouldn't hear any skip, you wouldn't hear anything. Below that frequency, you would hear. So is that a possibility? From what I'm describing, and is this calculatable? In other words, from day to day, can the MUF be defined as, you know, where it is in relation to frequency, and how can you compensate for that? Is that another possibility? Let's see, I'll give it back to you, Dick.
And my recollection is that it is calculatable with certain error bars, but if you know the state of the sunspot cycle and where you are in the season, summer, winter, spring, fall type stuff, and the angles and the frequencies you want to use, I believe it is calculatable. For lots and lots of years, and I don't know if it still exists, CQ Magazine would have a chart every month telling you what frequencies for what directions are usable, what time of the day. And they might tell you, for instance, if you want to talk to Brazil, you better do it on 40 meters or below if you want to do it on high noon. And if you want to talk to, and if you want to make them contact at midnight, well, you may be able to do it at 21 megacycles. There was charts like that. Various portions of the world were defined as to what frequency you use, what time of day. So there is a strong degree of predictability. There's an error margin to it, but very similar to the weatherman telling you it's going to rain tomorrow. He may be right 85% of the time. And these frequency prediction charts, I think, had a similar track record. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Marcus, this is K2KEY. You're right. Therefore, right. And I remember saying that. Therefore, the MUF cannot be expressed strictly for any particular frequency or any particular location. And like you say, those charts used to show East Coast, West Coast, you know, the whole business. The ionosphere, you must understand, is never uniform. So it wasn't 100% the prediction. The ionosphere never being really uniform. And in fact, at a given time or distance, the MUF would change many times very quickly. In fact, it would change, you know, you go for changes in any part of the earth, the MUF could be different. The MUF, you could say, would be the highest in the direction, usually. That was the rule of thumb at the time. How does you asked about the predictions. Okay, I remember now how they came up with the predictions. They figured out at the time that the MUF would always be the highest in direction towards the sun. So that would be east, to the east in the morning, to the south at noon. And this is northern latitudes where we are. I only know about where we are, I remember. And to the west in the afternoon and evening. This is the way the prediction was determined, Dick, over.
So there was some Kentucky windage, there was some past history, there's some experience, a little bit of black magic, a little bit of predicting of how many sunspot cycles you've got on the active observable section of the sun, because it takes a certain number of hours or days for the material squirted out by the sun to get to the Earth. If you have something like the SOHO satellite, which is giving you a nearly instantaneous snapshot of what is the sun doing now, and some number of hours or days later, the stuff that squirted, the sun is emitting, the solar mass expulsion, that material, that solar wind is going to hit you sometime later. So if you've got that kind of raw data, you can plug it into a good computer program or put it into the head of a guy that's smart enough, and he can come up with these charts for you and make predictions for the next day, 2 days, 4 days, week, month, and so on. Of course, the predictions get more and more fuzzy as you go further and further out in time, because the raw data you got is no longer as good. So predicting MUF for various portions of the world at various hours of the day from your particular location has a lot of the characteristics of predicting weather. Guaranteed that some websites are going to give you a better, more authoritative explanation than I've got on this one, Andy. It's A2CDL, K2RIW. K2RIW,
give you an update.
I heard somebody trying to get in, but very weak. Maybe you could raise your power. Maybe he has a comment. Okay. All right, very good. Yeah, I will look this up on the internet and look at some websites on it, because it is interesting. And I understand the heating and cooling of the atmosphere as you go higher in altitude and so on, and I understand why some radio stations, and I guess this is one example of how the layers, the F layer or the other layers, and I forget which ones change. Which one disappears at night? There's one that just disappears. Is that the F? I'm questioning it because I know that some radio stations have directional antennas, and these are usually on the broadcast band, the AM broadcast band, that is. I don't know about the FM stations, but the ones below 1 meg or so, they have directional antennas, and during the time of the day and at night and so on, they change their pattern or they change their power so they won't interfere. Because we used to, listening to on the AM stations from the car radio when we were kids, my father used to turn the radio on and said, "Hey, listen, we can hear radio stations hundreds of miles away in other states at night that you couldn't hear during the daytime." So we didn't understand why, but of course it makes sense now. Appreciate the information. Big back to you.
I think it was LQN that's trying to get in, and we are only hearing 50% every other word, so to speak. LQN, you want to try again? I think that was LQN, and unfortunately we were only getting every fourth word and only a half of those words, so you were more out than in, and we didn't get any sense out of that one, I'm sorry to say. The D layer is the one that disappears the fastest, Andy, is my understanding. The D layer is the one that's closest to the Earth. The air is most dense down there as far as all these possible layers are concerned. Therefore, the mean free path of any one air molecule, in other words, how far does it have to go before it comes into the vicinity of another molecule? It's a very short mean free path. Therefore, the D layer is going to be deionized most rapidly. I think you could say the D layer disappears within a few seconds when the sun goes down, as far as that section of the atmosphere is concerned. I don't mean the sun going down when you stand on the surface of the Earth. If you're in an airplane, you're at the altitude of the D layer, at the instant the sun goes down, your D layer recombines right away, and it's gone. And so the sun shining on all these layers of the atmosphere are giving you some beautiful ionization, and during the daytime, the D layer absorption just completely wipes out long-distance AM radio. The upper ionospheric levels are there reflecting the radio waves beautifully, but the waves don't get there because the D layer absorption down low sucks them up and turns them into heat before they get there. As soon as the sun goes down, your AM radio station from Canada, and I've done AM radio DXing from Canada and Chicago and Los Angeles and all kinds of long distances, when you find a clear channel radio, WKFI, I think it is, in Los Angeles, at nighttime, I think it's the only station on that frequency that's allowed to be on. And so at nighttime when the D layer disappears, but the upper layers are still there, you're going to hear these extremely long distances. And to try to control that, the FCC takes many of these stations and says you have to go down to a lower power at nighttime and or change the pattern of your transmitting setup at nighttime. I think the F1 and F2 layer are separate layers in the daytime, and I think they merge together at the nighttime. It's part of what goes on when the sun goes down. But the D layer is the one that disappears most rapidly, is my understanding. Mel, you want to correct me on that? K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Gotcha. Okay. The D and the E layers, okay, the two, the D and the E layers, what effect they have is the D and the E layer have this effect of absorbing energy. That's why, especially on the low amateur radio band, that's why you'll find like 160 and 80 meters, as Dick was just saying. When the sun angle is high around midday, you'll find that the effects of the E region ionization is absorbing, so that what happens is the D and E layer being active really at that point, to the point where they will absorb the wave energy, makes those bands basically unusable. You find very little, you know, activity on 160 and 80 meters, especially during the daytime, and that's why it comes alive at night. Now, there was one other thing I wanted to say about MUF. I'm coming back to me, you know. Now, basically, when they used to refer to MUF, like you say, you know, charts and all, they used to always tell you to try to work nearest the MUF, because they found that if you used the chart and worked as close to that MUF, that they would show that you would have the least loss from point A to point B at that time. So that way you got maximum usable frequency by using the frequency that at that point and that time of the day would give you the least loss. I think that's the best way to explain MUF, Dick, over.
Could very well be. But there's more to the story. It's complicated. And my understanding, I know, is partial. Mel's going to do it more than I have because he's more of an HF person. I spent very little of the last 20 years on HF. Spent more time on 10,000 megs than I have on 80 to 10 meters. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last time I made a QSO on 80 to 10 meters from my home. It might have been 1985. Long time ago. I've got HF equipment. The antenna needs repair, and the next real repair, when I finally get a chance to do some tower work, is going to be to, I think, to put up a 6-meter antenna and a better 432 antenna. 432 for a lot of years, my favorite band. And when you can toss day in and day out, summer, winter, spring, fall, 480 miles on single sideband on an overland path, primarily overland path. That was me and K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina. 479.5 miles separation between them. I call it 480. To me, that's a pretty long haul. And those are weak signals, and we had a lot of fun doing that every Tuesday night for half an hour for 4.5 years, starting around 1982 up to around 1986 to 87, we were doing that. And I'd like to go back to some of that. But that was an array of 16 Yagis, about 28 or 29 dB of gain over isotropic on 100 feet of tower. That was an antenna. 15 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. 5,000 cubic feet of antenna mounted at the top of my 100-foot tower. When you see a photograph of me in my QSL card where I'm standing in the middle of that antenna, I'm not a very significant portion of that antenna. And that had to all be assembled at the 100-foot level. That was one of my more heroic efforts that, by my standards, was very successful. I got a lot of fun out of that. That was going to be one huge article which I was going to explain what real long-range tropo was like and what aircraft reflection is like and what snow scatter is like on 432 and lightning scatter and other kinds of phenomena. That's another one we haven't mentioned, lightning scatter. There are bursts of lightning that will, on very long haul, give you an ionized pass that lasts for a fraction of a second and can give you some very intense signals. And meteor scatter at 432 is a bit rare, but it does take place. I don't think meteor scatter has ever been seen at 1296, but I'm not sure. I think there are radars that have seen echoes off of meteor trails, L-band radars at the 1215 megacycles. I think that has occurred. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give us your call letters right now. K2RW in the TechNet.
K2KE, one more thing there.
Mel recognized. Anyone else with a question or comment? You got it, Mel.
Hey, I just dug out an old chart on MUF. Maybe this is even an easier way to explain it. This chart gives you all between East Coast United States and Europe for any time of the day between 3 megahertz and 70 megahertz. And it basically tells you, you go along and you look, you pick out the time, you know, on the clock here. You pick out the time and you look at the line that crosses it at the lowest loss. That is the maximum usable frequency. In other words, they will tell you, I mean, on this chart at that time. Now, they caution you that, you know, this is depends on the cycle. It also depends on the sun's habit that it's been forming for the last few days. But usually, they said that it was pretty good for that particular prediction for that month. So, in other words, you say you want to talk to Europe at, 12 noon. You go across, you look at 12 noon, and then you look at the other line that's going across, and it shows you which one will give you the maximum usable frequency for the least amount of hops to Europe at that time. So in other words, it just gives you what frequency at that, where you should be at that particular time if you wanted to talk to Europe from East Coast, Dick, over.
Yeah. When you get a chance, you got to read a couple of specifics, like when that chart was published. At high noon, you can't go above, you can't go below 7 megacycles. And at midnight to Europe, maybe you can use 3.5 megacycles. A couple of specifics would help. And after that, I think you ought to consider opening up your mailbag. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, just a quick one. This is, when was this published? My God, let me take a look. This is an oldie. 1999, I think it is. Yep, 99. So it's long gone. For instance, you said 12 noon. Let's see. 12 noon to Europe. Let's see. Well, they show which part of Western Europe. Okay, we'll go to Western Europe. 14230. That's 20 meters. 14230 about 12 noon will give you. Now, in fact, you look at this. You can actually look at the frequency. They actually show you a little bit of like a curve, and it shows you that the peak, the MUF. If you want to know what amateur radio band at 12 noon on that particular day to Western Europe would be 14.230. Dick, over.
Okay, that's high noon. What would it be, 6 o'clock at night? What would it be midnight?
Okay, let's see. Now, let's go to midnight. Let's go to the other extreme. At, 2400, 000, right, Google. Let's look down here. And it says here that 3.850 at about midnight is the maximum. Again, the maximum MUF, the MUF to Western Europe from the East Coast. Dick, over.
Now, the way that chart is made, is it really the highest frequency that will work, or is it the optimum frequency that gives you the least number of bounces between here and there? In fact, as long as you're willing to tolerate a different number of bounces, maybe a slightly higher frequency would still work, just not quite as well.
Of course, you know. They're showing you what you'll get the most bang for your buck. In other words, if you were to go on this 3.850 at midnight to Western Europe, and do it with, say, a moderate antenna, a dipole, and 100 watts, you'll most likely get the same signal report if you went to, say, 20 meters. This is, of course, at that time, because I'm looking at 20 meters. You could have done it also at 20 meters, but they show you the MUF on 20 is considerably, you know, the curve is considerably down. So what would happen, you most likely go to 20 meters, put your three or four element beam with a kilowatt on, and if that's the same station, you see, say, well, boy, you're doing just as good or better on 80 meters right now with your 100 watts in your dipole than you're doing with your beam and your kilowatt on 20 meters. And the reason, of course, that will be for, I guess, strictly because the number of hops take over.
Okay. And number of hops, that's part of it. As I go down in frequency, many of my antennas are going to give me a higher takeoff angle. Therefore, you would think the number of hops increases at the lower frequency. But maybe the answer is that because there's so many hops at the lower frequency, the signal now has a zillion ways to get there at once, and one of them is going to make it. Whereas when I'm on the 20-meter band at that same time, I've got so few hops, you hope that one makes it, so to speak. Everything's got to be just right. Maybe that's part of what's going on, Mel? CKP?
CKP, I believe it is recognized. Yeah, well, for instance, they give you also part of it. You know, it's a whole chart that they used to print. And they show you, for instance, like you say, 20 meters noon time. And they show you the actual reflection of each one of the layers. And they show you the actual reflection of 20 meters to Europe. At that time, at 14230, it's all due to the F2 layer. And there's some bending. They actually show you, you know, there is some bending due to the E and the F1 layer. But basically, at that time, the work is all being done by the F2 layer. And this is as you see as it travels through the day, as the bending now changes from the F2 to the F1 to the E layer, and so on and so forth, over.
Okay, I think we're slowly getting the story here. Mr. CKP, please give us your full call and your name, and then proceed, sir. My name is Dick.
Yes, good evening, Dick. Call sign is Whiskey Alpha 2 Charlie Kilo Papa. Name is Bob over in Bayside. The only correction I could add to what's being talked about is that the time given is also a UTC, I believe. My father had a, I think you'd call it one of these magic wheels. And what you would do is you'd line up UTC, what time of day you'd like to talk to where. And on the other end, it would have a little square, and you'd flip it over, and it would tell you exactly what, well, not exactly, but, you know, it's all black magic anyway. It would tell you what band that you should be able to talk to point A to point B. And that's just it. But I believe the time on the charts are WA2CKB back to that.
Yeah, Zulu time, Dick.
That makes sense. Zulu or universal time makes a lot of sense, because if I talk about high noon propagation here in New York and I'm talking to a man in London, there's a healthy 4 or 5 hours of difference between what we think is high noon. And so where is the terminator? In other words, in many cases, propagation changes quite rapidly when the terminator is midway between you and the guy you want to talk to. In other words, if the sun is just setting in the middle of the Atlantic, when I'm talking to my buddy in London, quite possibly we're going to experience significant change, and the possibility exists that we should QSY to another suggested frequency by these charts, and we'll have an easier time of it. Anyone agree or disagree with that? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Agree, and also you can go across the pond or over the pole. It also comes into play.
Yeah, and maybe you're sort of, Bob, getting into long path versus short path. In other words, the point that's almost on the opposite part of the Earth from me is a certain portion of Australia. And so if I want to talk to my buddy in Australia, which way do I aim my antenna? Where is the terminator as far as the hold on Earth is concerned? And even if I'm talking to somebody in Brisbane, and maybe Brisbane, the short path is to the southeast and the long path is to the northwest, I'm not sure, but maybe that's true. One path may work very much better than the other, depending where the sun is right now, which is a fancy way of saying what is the universal time of day at the Greenwich Meridian, GMT. So I presume there are times when long path and short path are happening simultaneously. You may hear a little bit of an echo or delay effect between the two, and the two signals, long and short path, may end up occasionally canceling with each other and occasionally enhancing each other. So you must be the possibility of getting some pretty strong QSD because of long path and short path interference. I wonder if that's partially true, Bob. Back to you.
Got a comment, too, on that there.
Yeah, I'm just going to take a comment and duck out. Oh, yeah, you know, Dick, this is like the old-time black and white and color photography. It's a little bit of black magic in there. Oh, let me run out to the bank, WACCKB, but I'll be back to listen.
That man is going to the bank at 11 o'clock at night. Hey, Bob, can you get me a sample? That must be one hell of a bank. Over to you, Bill.
Yeah, well, it's going to be very careful. This is KTKTY. Okay. Now, in this kind of chart, yeah, I was, of course, just translating all the, everything's on, of course, Zulu time on the chart. Now, they show at that time when this chart was made that you were talking about, you know, different going, you know, the long path, short path. And they showed that this time when this chart was made, the maximum distance that can be covered on a single hop was 4,000 kilometers. Everything more than that, any distances covered more than that, was through to multiple hops. So they show you that the skip distance is known as the critical angle, and that they show you, you know, long path, short path. And, of course, I did that long path experiment one time on the heyday of 20 meters with my friend in Massachusetts on 20 meters. Never could hear him on 20 meters with, you know, with the skip condition. However, that time we had one propagation where the north-south condition was ideal. And in fact, what we did, he went north with his beam over the pole, I went south over the South Pole, and we made communication. So somebody asked, what is the furthest you've ever worked? I said, Massachusetts. And they said, oh, yeah, really? I said, yeah, but around the long way around the world, Dick, over.
That makes your QSO, what, about 20,000 miles or 22,000 miles, Mil?
I don't know. What would be what's the distance around the world via the poles? I don't know what the exact is, but yes, it's considerable. Well, the furthest spot from my QTH is to my friend Jerry, VK6GK. He's in Tasmania. It's 10,600 miles. We've had quite a number of contacts over the year. We work each other fairly regular on 20 meters. After that, you're actually returning, Dick, over.
Yeah, let's assume that the distance between you and Boston was, I'm going to pick a number, 400 miles. And let's assume that the whole distance around the Earth is 24,000 miles. So if you go long path to Boston, it's 24,000 miles minus 400, 23,600 miles. Now, that's quite a QSO.
Well, you know, okay, got the feedback here. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, 20 meters, did a lot of long paths. A lot of people would be calling, you know, especially European stations and all, stations out of the Middle East and everything. At night, you used to hear them calling via long path. They used to all, like, especially for over the pole, think over.
Yeah, and if your guy is, I can't think of the call letters now, this Japanese ham, who has a, I think it's a fully rotatable six-element beam on 80 meters, about 180 feet long. if you've got a fully rotatable antenna on 80 meters, you can choose exactly what path you want for any part of the world. You own the band and you load it to people periodically when you're not on. And with an antenna like that, you can blast through the D layer, get into the ionosphere, and talk to somebody where it is, the sun is shining where you are, but it's dark where he is. Therefore, he's not getting D-layer absorption when the signal comes back down from the ionosphere in his locale. And you're blasting through with pure raw power and an effective radiative power of your antenna gain on your side. That could be a lot of fun. Whenever you transmit a radio signal, it goes everywhere in the universe. And the only thing left to discuss, as you've heard me say so often, is that signal above threshold for the receiver you're using at this time? And there are better and better techniques that will tolerate weaker and weaker signals. The Joe Taylor K1JT techniques are getting heavily involved in that, where he is operating at times with minus 28 dB signal to noise ratio. In other words, the signal you want to listen to, a weak Morse code-like signal. It's actually a mixture of four tones and various combinations, but the signal you want to listen to is 28 dB below the noise of your receiving system. And he can give you a 98% copy of that message with his fancy digital signal processing-like technique. So you ain't seen nothing yet. And you start studying what the radio astronomers do when they start doing synchronous demodulation radiometry techniques. Wow. They can listen to a star where the star passing in front of their radio telescope changes the temperature of the noise power coming out of the radio telescope by 1 degree Kelvin. And they're using a mixer front-end receiver at some, you know, ridiculously high frequency, like 60 gigahertz. And so they got a 1,000-degree or a 10,000-degree Kelvin receiver noise temperature. And you would think that a 1-degree Kelvin star waving in front of an antenna is going to be like sitting in the ocean. You're never going to see it. And they give you a beautiful picture of what that star looks like as far as the star chart is concerned. They can resolve it with radiometry techniques and thinking switching techniques, which is a kind of synchronous demodulation. So if you're smart enough in the way you design the receiver, and if you've got enough of intelligence about
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you've got enough raw data about the signal itself, you would be constantly amazed at how weak a signal you can listen to. Another example is the way the Global Positioning Satellite Receiver System works. It works with an average signal level of 24 dB below the noise. Rather amazing stuff. And with any further comments, if my mind's going blank here, if Paul WS2N is available, he ought to type up and say so. K2RIW listening.
One more comment, Dick, on something that was, you know, we were talking about angle of antennas.
Okay, you got the floor, Mel.
As I said, you know, on 6 meters, I had tried that using two rotors, you know, at the time, because everybody was saying, oh, you move the antenna a little up, a little angle, and it's going to, oh, it's going to be magic. It has had some effect. However, you know, now getting back, remember, to my receiving loop that I use on 75 meters, I do get that effect more pronounced on 75 meters. I will tilt that receiving loop, you know, at peak. Remember I said, you know, I tilt it, and sometimes it's in the vertical mode, and I'm receiving my friend in Pennsylvania very well. Other times I move that towards more towards the horizontal mode, and I can actually get a better peak on that signal. It seems more pronounced, that change of angle of the antenna on 75 meters than I've seen on 6 meters. Tip over.
Oh boy, do I believe that. Let me reset. We are talking about the absorption and re-radiation of the ionized plasma level layer that we call ionosphere. Whenever you have a mixture of ionized plasma, that's a redundancy of terms there. Plasma is by definition an ionized medium. But when you've got an ionized medium in the presence of a magnetic field, and you're sending a radio-like signal through it, you will get Faraday rotation. It's Faraday studied this effect and got his name associated with it. So you may launch a horizontal signal. In the process of going through that ionosphere, it may twist three times and come out in vertical to your buddy in London. And when that guy in London sends a signal back to you in that direction going through the ionosphere, instead of twisting 3.5 times, it may only twist 2 times and come out horizontal to you. So polarization, rotation, and the fading it creates is another very complicated dynamic phenomena of the ionosphere. So where you've got this simple loop antenna, which doesn't have anywhere near the gain and steerability of that six-element Yagi, of that Japanese amateur, the full six-element Yagi on 80 meters, you've just got a simple loop, which you can't do quite as much accuracy of steering, but you have complete accuracy of polarization. You've got complete control of polarization. As you rotate your loop, you can make it horizontal, vertical, slant 45 right, slant 45 left, whatever. And for each instant of time that you're receiving that signal from your buddy in Pennsylvania or your friend in London, there is an ideal polarization for you to hear his signal. And there's a slightly different ideal polarization for you to send a signal back to him during this particular 10-minute period of time. I'll bet you've also, during the QSO, seen a small amount of rotation of the ideal polarization. I wonder if that's true, Paul. I mean, no. K2KEY, K2LIW.
K2KEY. I saw so many crazy effects, Dick, that I would never, if I didn't see, you know, what was happening with this receiving loop, these effects of, you know, sometimes, how can you explain to somebody, I got an outside loop, I think we went through this, that 45 feet up, that 272 feet of wire, fed with open wire feeders into a balanced tuner and all this kind, and you're going to tell me that this 12-foot triangle you got sitting in your radio shack will produce, in many cases, a better signal. I mean, you know, you say that, especially on 75, I've said this a number of times, Steve, wait a minute, I'm going to turn towards you, I'm going to pick you up. You know, their ears must have perked up and says, what is this guy up to? What has he got? What is he talking about? In Brooklyn, he's got some kind of a rotating 80-meter antenna. You know, I'm sure they must think that this guy, you know, is pulling our leg. And yet, I tell you the truth, if I spoke to somebody not knowing what I've gone through, you know, what I've seen, observed, I would say also that, you know, this is ridiculous, over.
It's another one of these things where once you understand it, it appears to be common sense. But without that understanding, it sounds crazy. And it sounds like you're creating a hoax and just making up a tall tale. So I'm sure you've had a fair amount of flack and flaming nasty comments and saying that, hey, you got to be fibbing, you got to be lying, what in the world are you smoking, Mr. Schneider, this can't be taking place. I'm sure you've heard more than that in your time. Very similar to what I run into when I tell people about, you can always get absolutely perfect 1.001-to-1 standing wave ratio on any dipole that's inside of or not inside of any kind of antenna, if you know what you're doing, with very simple techniques. I tell people that, and a few people who are very smart in the antenna world will say, absolutely right on, about time somebody write that down in a usable form. The majority of people say, what in the world is this guy talking about, and why should I bother? Well, there's some very good reasons why you should bother, in my opinion. Okay, do you think you've got anything good in the mailbag that we should go to, Mel? That's up to you, K2RIW.
Okay, I guess I'll be doing some thought reading over. I didn't read any of them over because I got involved in this discussion tonight, which nostalgia. So I sort of usually, you know, listen while Paul is giving a state report. I usually, you know, just thumb through the email. But let's put it this way. I think you hit the nail right on the head, Dick. There's a lot more to this stuff than we really understand at times. Many times it just doesn't do what we think we should be predicting. This is the strange part. And as I said, I've had a lot of experience. It's very hard. I don't get into controversy too much on 75 anymore because a lot of it is ridiculous. But if I didn't observe, I could say with my own eyes and my own ears, I would also, you know, be very skeptical about whether these things really take place. All right, so let me go. I'll try to thumb through them real quick and see if I can pick out ones that we can use on the air without me having my license sliced up into confetti by Mr. Riley Hollingsworth, the FCC, over.
Okay, while you're reading, anyone else up within the sound of our voice who's got a question or comment, give us your call letters and name right now.
WB2HWW with a quick comment.
You got it, Howie.
Yeah, I haven't done it yet, but that's the reason why I'm making these inverted Vs, or what I want to do is get multiple horizontal polarizations. Very interesting if you do that. I know a couple guys were fooling around with that with their repeater system using both horizontal and vertical, and they're getting some really good results on the band opens up. They can get, they don't get as much of a deep fade, and they get a lot better reception.
Yeah, an inverted V, first of all, when you and I read any of the good books, the license manual, the radio amateur's handbook, the antenna handbook of ARRL, or any of these others, and you look up the word dipole, 97% of the time, you'll see a dipole as a straight-out piece of wire with a feed line coming off at right angles to it from the center. And everybody is led to believe that that is a dipole, that you're not allowed to use any other configuration, feeding it off-center like a Wyndham, changing the length from half wavelength, tilting it in any particular angle like a sloper, making it higher in the center than the edges, which is called an inverted V, or zigzagging it. And I'm now talking about zigzagging it in three-dimensional space. Professionally, for the last couple of weeks, I've been experimenting with an antenna that has to be zigzagged in funny ways in three-dimensional space, not to save volume, but to squeeze it around all the other important objects that are on a product that's under development. So we've got this crazy kind of three-dimensional zigzag of a dipole-like antenna. And after we finally figured out how to use our instrumentation correctly on the antenna range, we discovered the thing has near 100% efficiency. No great surprise to me. But the normal nulls that you get off the edge of a dipole, off the ends of a dipole, are completely gone. The signal off the ends of this crazy zigzag thing are 1.5 dB down, not the 40 dB down null you would get from a normal dipole. An inverted V has some of this effect. Off the ends of an inverted V, you do not have a null. You've got rather pure vertical polarization off the end, and broadside, you've got more clearly horizontal polarization radiated by the antenna. Now, after either of those signals have been through the ionosphere, that's another whole issue. So we're discovering with this three-dimensional zigzag thing, which is even a step or two beyond an inverted V, that it becomes extremely close to omnidirectional in total radiated pattern. But now if I wanted to plot the horizontal pattern exclusively, I would think I see some null. If I plot the vertical pattern exclusively, I would think I see some null. And the same thing for the 45 slant degree polarization. But if I look at all possible polarizations in all possible directions, the antenna is nearly isotropic. After Sedan, let me drop a second. And for Sedan many years, I've been hearing that you can't build an isotropic antenna. And as long as I'm not being polarization persnickety, if I'm allowing all possible polarizations, including some elliptical polarization, and I rapidly discovered this antenna is very close to isotropic. And for the particular application, it has some very nice characteristics that we're slowly falling in love with. Now, because the antenna itself is packed in so tight with a whole bunch of other stuff, batteries and circuit boards and liquid crystal displays, computers and everything else, we are getting some other funny coupling effects, which requires some control. But still, here we are. I mean, Heinrich Hertz with his dipole, I don't know the exact year, but he probably did it way back in 1870. And here we are 137 years later, quote, inventing, unquote, new kinds of dipoles and new ways of feeding them. That sounds like the oldest story in the world. It's got some newness to it. Mel's loop antennas that are rotatable in azimuth elevation and polarization. Sounds like the oldest story in the world. He's discovering some new things that people think they don't believe it. They better take him seriously. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Anybody else want to make any comments about any of Bob?
Dick, if you take two inverted Vs and have one go north and south, one go east and west, and phase them 90 degrees down the phase, you'll get a perfectly horizontal vertical. You'll get a perfect isotropic in whatever polarization you look at.
That's a subset of a turnstile antenna, Howie. I could take a straight-out dipole horizontal and one north-south and one east-west and see the 90 degrees out of phase. Top view and bottom view is circular polarized. On the horizon, it is omnidirectional, that is, turnstile-like, and people have, as an FM broadcast antenna, sold and used that for a lot of decades. And it's got some desirable characteristics. And there's big wheel versions of that, three-leaf clover and four-leaf clover versions of that, and big wheel versions of that. I'm discussing now an antenna that doesn't have a 90-degree phase shifter, doesn't have two feed points, has one single feed point. And as long as you're not polarization persnickety, the antenna within a dB or so is omnidirectional, isotropic. Isotropic meaning it transmits as much signal straight up, straight down, straight forward, straight back, straight to the left, and straight to the right. It's covering all six directions, so to speak. That's a little bit amazing to me. I didn't expect to see that. When I first started testing the antenna, I said, gee, the gain's a little bit low. I soon found out it's squirting energy in a whole lot of other directions that I'm not used to seeing. And when we finally discovered that, we said, okay, what's the overall efficiency? Well, you put 10 watts into it, and 9.5 watts is being radiated, 9.8 watts is being radiated in space. You can't blame it for inefficiency once we cured the coupling to other stuff that was on board. So, you ain't heard the end of simple dipoles. I put the word simple in quotes. Back to you, Mel.
KC2MHY for comment.
MHY, go ahead, start up with your name.
And the name is Kevin, Kilo Echo Victor, India, November. Hey, Dick, I just want to make a comment out there. I do run HF. I'll be on 20 meters. I'll be on 40 meters, and I'm running ham sticks. And I live up here in the projects. I'm up on the 8th floor, and my antenna is basically out on a 45-degree angle due to the fact I can't put anything really basically up on the roof. Hey, but it gets out. You can ask Mel. I talk to Mel sometimes when he's basically on 10 meters and everything. And the only the thing about horizontal antennas, there, you know, they get out and everything. Hey, but I don't know whether would it be better vertical or anything like that. But I'll tell you one thing, Dick. To be up on the 8th floor and everything, I think that compensates. For me, really basically getting out. And I have spoken to people in Italy, Puerto Rico, and I got U.S. cards all over the place. So how you like that, Dick, there for
you know, my ham sticks there that I'm running over here. Back over to you.
Very fine, Kevin. The eighth floor was giving you a lot of advantage, no two ways about it. You've got some real altitude, 80, 90 feet above the turf. Second of all, if those ham sticks, I'm not sure, are the kind where you are approaching half-wavelength electronically. I mean, you could build a monopole-like antenna where it's quarter wavelength long and it needs a great big ground plane to work well. And the ground plane is not quite as required when you're up high like eight floors. But as you approach half wavelength, 5/8 wave or half wave, spiraled antenna, then the simple metal railing of your balcony can be a perfect counterpoise, and now you can do some very high efficiency radiating of that antenna. And whether you set it horizontal, vertical, or slant 45 is your choice. And each one of those possibilities will have different amounts of advantages on different days, depending on who you're talking to. You would have quite a bit of fun, Kevin, if you added some kind of a motor mechanism where the antenna could be tilted from straight up to 45 degree angle to straight out, horizontal to vertical, and maybe even a couple of other angles. If you had a motor on there and you could rotate it, as you talk to different guys, different hours of the day, I think you'll find different settings of that motor that'll give you ideal performance. So, although what you've got is working very well, I think there's a chance with some fairly simple additions, you can even have some more fun and make it work better. I wonder if you ever considered that, Kevin. Back to you, Kevin.
I will consider that there, Dick, and I'm going to see if I'm able to really run it there that way also, but thanks a lot for your comment. But, you know, I just wanted to just really put that in there, because since you guys were talking about antennas on a 45-degree angle, and I used to even be down on 11 meters there, too, there, Dick. Hey, before I really became an amateur radio operator, and I used to even do some good DX from up here, too. Incredible, man, on sideband. It's really incredible. You know, I heard you guys talking about the polarization of the antenna, and 45-degree angle's not bad. Ain't considering there, but thanks a lot there, Dick, and I'll take a pause over here, and I'll let somebody else get a chance to get in there. KC2MHY. Back over to you, Dick.
K2CSX.
CSX recognized. CSX. Okay. Part of the reason I'm recommending you try that motor to move it in polarization from up to out to in between and whatever is part of the result of what Mel is discovering. Although he's using a looped antenna, there's nothing magic about his loop itself. Whether he's using a loop or a compacted super dipole-like thing or a ham stick or whatever, and he's got some altitude, as long as you have control of polarization for this hour of the day, for this guy you're talking to, guarantee there are times you're going to find improvement, because we all keep forgetting about Faraday rotation. That signal going through the ionosphere, even though it started off horizontal, it doesn't stay horizontal. It twists some number of times as it goes through the ionosphere. And it can come out the other end very different in polarization than what you launch. And so if you've got control of polarization, you've got another great big knob you can twist and do some fun. Mr. CXX, Charlie Sierra X-ray, it sounds like. I'm not sure if you signed in already. I haven't found you on my list. Give me the full call and name and proceed, sir. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, what's going on? Hello, too, Charlie Sugar X-ray. Mark here in the Bronx. I experiment also, sort of like Kevin, with a HF antenna outside the bedroom window. I'm in a five-story walk-up, and I live on the fourth floor, and I have a MFJ 1664 screwdriver antenna perched outside my bedroom window, clamped onto a window mountable window of the window guard, and I have the antenna screwed into that, and I seem to get out pretty well on all bands. I even have a redundant measure of
possible mark. The battery died on him. Stand by a little bit.
Screwdriver antenna fell down.
very few people use a screwdriver antenna at 2 meters. I can come back, Mark. Okay, he may have had a zap battery that died. We'll come back to Mark after Mel gives us one of the gems out of his mailbag. Go ahead, Mel.
You hit the nail on the head again when you said gem. I'm looking through. Now, here's one. See, this is funny. I don't know. Some years ago, I visited a LORAN site, and they were pumping. You had a pump system, and they said that this was delivering thousands of gallons of salt water under the operation of the building, the LORAN building, and the four towers. And they said without this, when you have the soil dried out, this is to maintain Earth ground. Is this correct? Gee, I never heard of that. Did they really pump salt water under a LORAN system, Dick? Does that sound something familiar to you? Over.
I think it's very possible the truth. Let me let the machine beep.
Standing by.
Sounds like Mark is back. We'll go to him in a second. Quite possibly true, Mark. I mean, Mel. When you study the books on LORAN C, the navigation system, which I think runs at 100 kilohertz, and it runs something like a megawatt of power at 100 kilohertz, the antenna system that does that transmitting is quite an extremely interesting piece of engineering. When you study those LORAN C books, you'll discover that the system is primarily intended for maritime navigation within, let me pick a number, 200 miles of our coastline. That's what its major intent is, to allow you to find your particular port, and on a really good day, your particular slip to bring the boat back to on a foggy night. That's what you'd like to be able to do with LORAN C. And you get the best of all worlds if you get LORAN C and the global positioning satellite system. You'll also discover when you read the books that there are people using LORAN C for terrestrial navigation, where they're driving their car within a couple of hundred miles of the seashore. And because the wave propagates differently over land than it does over water, you have to add certain correction factors. The wave propagates, I believe, a little bit more slowly over land. It gets delayed. So conductivity of seawater is what's creating the phenomenon. Conductivity of land is nowhere near as high. Because you're trying to make the soil around your antenna act like a perfect ground plane and not act like a dummy load, to pump salt water into that soil strikes me as a very reasonable thing to do. If you don't do that, the partial conductivity of that soil is going to make it act like a dummy load. It's equivalent to putting a fluorescent bulb near your 2-meter antenna when you're radiating 100 watts into it. You'll watch the fluorescent bulb light, and a smart guy will say, hey, yeah, I'm getting energy into that fluorescent bulb and it's lighting, but I'm sucking up that energy. It ain't being radiated into space anymore. It's being converted into light of that light bulb, and the guy listening on 2 meters is not going to hear as much from me. Well, you can do the same thing with dummy load in the near field of your antenna. And at 100 kilohertz antenna, it's got a huge near field. So all the dirt around it for, I'm going to pick a number, 500 feet in all directions, down, out, and whatever, that conductivity counts. So I'm not amazed that they pump salt water and maybe water with other nutrients, other conducting substances in it. I'm not surprised at all, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Let me ask you something. Wouldn't it be better off if they put down a ground radio? Rather than this salt water business, I would think that it would be much better to put down ground radio. I would say like a ham put down for vertical. Why don't they just put down ground radio, take over?
I'm glad you asked that question. Boy, am I glad you asked that question. You're a man who's very good with mathematics. You've got some of these great equations. If I'm at 100 kilohertz, a tenth of a megacycle, and I want my ground plane radio to be a quarter wavelength long, do a quick piece of mathematics, mental mathematics, Mr. Schneider. How long would be the quarter wavelength at 100 kilohertz? Are you sure you want to lay down wire that many miles long Back to you, Bill.
Oh, it's safe. You know why I say that? Because